Love Sport Radio. On digital radio, online, mobile, and smart speaker. This is Upfront on Love Sport.
This is the James Gray Show podcast edition. Please do leave us a rating or a review wherever you get your podcasts. And remember, you can tune into the show every weekday from 1 p.m. until 3:30 p.m. on Love Sport Radio.
This is Love Sport.
We have to talk about that dramatic night at Elland Road last night. I mean, just one of them, the playoffs seem to throw up these games. You know, we all remember that Watford-Leicester game, the missed penalty going down the end, scoring another goal. But it happens every year. Because of the format of the playoffs, because of the what's at stake, the severity, the absolutely brutal nature of it, it kind of automatically becomes unbelievably tense. Sometimes it means you get quite stifled games. Playoff finals, for example, are more often than not 1-0. Decided by a single goal, because they can be so tense, because there's so much being at stake, so much what feels like so much to lose in what they call the £100 million game in the final. And that'll be Villa versus Derby, we know that now. There was a time, of course, when Aston Villa versus Derby County would have been a pretty serious clash, you know, ramifications at the very top of English football. 20 years ago, actually, both teams finished in the top half of the Premier League, funnily enough. They were 6th and 8th, split by Liverpool, and Leeds, by the way, finished 4th that year in the European places, 15 points clear of them. It's amazing how long that is in football. 10 years later, by the way, the last time Derby and Villa met in the top flight, Derby had Robbie Savage, Andy Todd and Roy Carroll all in the starting lineup, and they were beaten 6-0 by Villa. Gareth Barry scored, John Carew and Gabby Agbonlahor all on the team sheet. And that was only a decade ago. So it tells you how quickly, and you know, Manchester United are learning this, how quickly things can go wrong for clubs at any level. You know, Aston Villa were, and probably still are, a really big club in English football. They were in the Premier League for a long, long time from its inception. And I know that football didn't start then because they won the European Cup back in 82 as well. You know, the likes of Kenny Swain and Nigel Spink, all involved. So they are a club with real history, real roots as well, in one of the biggest cities. And now they find themselves pitted against Derby in a game that's actually arguably bigger than any of their previous clashes. Financially, certainly. They call it the £100 million game, but actually it can be worth a lot more than that. It's almost like a minimum £100 million game, because that's the kind of revenue getting into the Premier League, and even if you come straight back down again, the parachute payments ensure that you will make a lot of money out of winning that one game of football. And I think, crucially, it's going to bring at least one of the, well, yeah, just one, of the big sides of English football back to the top flight. I've nothing against Norwich or Sheffield United, who have their own history, I'm sure. And similarly, I don't begrudge Huddersfield their success, or Fulham, or whoever it happens to be. But I will always see, and maybe it is rose-tinted glasses, I'll always see Aston Villa as a big club. I'll always think of them as a top-flight side. Until their relegation, you know, the Remy Gard era, if you want to call it that, they were one of the ever-presents, and the Holt End, every other week, was one of the loudest bits of England. It was amazing. And it was so sad when the club, the fans and the ownership, Randy Lerner, started to prise themselves apart, and this rift developed, and they started no-showing in the Holt End. You know, one of the most historic ends of a football ground in England. We used to play FA Cup semi-finals at Villa Park, and now we're lucky if we get a playoff semi-final. For the second year in a row, we have, and they've got through it for the second year in a row. Similarly, Leeds. I was actually kind of desperate for Leeds to get through last night. And I know that we sort of are required by law to hate Leeds. I've no idea why, but it does happen a lot. You know, even when they were a great side in the 70s, they were kind of looked down upon. They had someone like Eddie Gray on the wing, one of the most graceful players around. To the extent that Chopper Harris claims he won the FA Cup final by kicking Eddie Gray in the leg and making sure that he didn't have an influence on the game. And even when they won the title in 92, again, they were looked down upon. They just were never seen as a fashionable side for whatever reason. So we hate Leeds. I don't. I was born there. I'm still supposed to hate Leeds. But like Villa, I will always see them as a big team. And one of those reasons is Elland Road. Why do you think Leeds are on TV so much? Why do you think they've come back from the depths that they did, down at the bottom end of the Football League, close to administration, even liquidation? The reason they've bounced back from it all is because they are a big club. They're intrinsically a big club. They have one of the most exciting grounds in English football. They're right on top of you. The atmosphere last night was electric, and it rightly so, because Leeds were on the verge of a playoff final place. They went 2-0 up in the tie, and we all know what happened after that. You know, stop Frank Lampard crying and the rest of it. But the reality is that Elland Road is a dramatic place to watch football, and it's always like that. It's always got an edge to it. And there's no necessarily a rhyme or reason for that, but it is a terrific ground, and I want it back in the Premier League. Maybe one day it will be, but it won't be this year. And home and away last night were loud. It was fiery. It was furious. It was what we want from football. It's what makes English football as great as it is. Those packed grounds every week. And yeah, it's great that it happens in the second tier too. But we want Leeds to be playing Manchester United, Arsenal, Manchester City, Liverpool every week. That's what you want to see as a football fan. And I don't care if you're one of these I hate Leeds people. If you are a football fan, you want Leeds back in the top flight, because they're such a dramatic team to watch. And for all that Leeds have fallen apart again, and it is catchy, they produced an epic game of football last night with so many fabulous moments. Mason Mount's stooping finish, Stuart Dallas's two-footed celebration that if there'd been a player in the way, definitely would have got him sent off, the finish for his second goal, the winner from Jack Marriott 5 minutes from the end, Jack Marriott scoring with his first touch after a defensive mix-up. Don't take away from Leeds that it takes two to tango. To have these great ties, you need both teams to contribute. Istanbul wouldn't have been the game it was if Milan hadn't gone 3-0 up. The Nou Camp in 99 wouldn't have been the game it was if Bayern Munich hadn't been the force, the dominant force for 90 minutes that they were. Had Barcelona not played brilliantly in the first leg, we wouldn't have had that great comeback. Similarly, Ajax, were they not such a good side? Tottenham would never have had the chance to do what they did. So yes, to the winner, the spoils. And in this case, to Frank Lampard and Derby, the spoils. But give Leeds some credit too, because frankly, they put on one heck of a show.
Love Sport.
Love or hate Frank Lampard, and there are differing opinions on him, I don't think you can hate watching him celebrate last night. It's that passion. I'm getting little heart signs for the control room with the Chelsea fans sitting in the box. That is pathetic. You can't hate watching that passion being involved in football and one of the greats getting back involved with the game. Let's speak to another one of Derby greats. Sean Barker is on the line, a former Derby club captain. Sean, your nerves must be in bits today.
It was a remarkable evening, remarkable performance. It had, in a game, as much as you can think for talking points, sending offs, bookings. It was back and forwards like a heavyweight boxing match in terms of the two teams going for it. And it was just unbelievable to watch and to kind of to witness. And I think going into the second leg against Leeds, they were clear underdogs, and I think that helped. I think that helped the side. Frank obviously told them to go out there and express themselves and be on the front foot, and you saw a fantastic game of football.
Do you think it also helped? You said the underdog tag helped them a little bit. Do you think it also helped that? I know what time it is now, Sean. Thank you very much for that. do you think it also helped that Derby players and Frank Lampard had to listen to so much of Leeds chanting as though they'd already won the game? Do you think that will fire them up a bit?
I think so. I think there's an element of that. Obviously, three games previous, we've been put to the sword by Leeds this season. They've been far superior in them three prior games. But we know what playoffs are like. We know that it's all about moments. The goal just before half-time changed things. I'm sure Frank would have riled them up with, you know, this is an opportunity to kind of stick your fingers up at them almost and really go at them and put them under pressure. And the second half, it came out a different team, full of belief, full of confidence, I suppose ready to prove critics wrong, because everyone's, you know, put them as the underdogs and not really fancy them going through to the final. And the second half proved just how important it is to have belief and to kind of take any sort of measures to make it happen and get to the final.
What have you made of Frank Lampard's first season in management? Obviously, it's a success to get to the playoff final, although he will know as much as anyone that the job is only half done. He seems like someone who wears his heart on his sleeve, and players seem to really respond to that.
They do. He's obviously hugely respected around the world for how he was as a player, how he conducted himself, the attitude and application he gave, you know, his football. And that's kind of continued with his management. I said at the start of the season, a top six finish would be a huge achievement for him in his first season. There's lots of players that have come in. His connections with obviously top clubs in this country have allowed him to bring the likes of Mount, Wilson, Tomori up to the club. And obviously, you know, you can go to Wembley and you can lose it, and it's still going to be a successful season. But they just enjoyed the moment. I think Frank said it will be a different emotion to playing, overseeing these young players, especially to get them to Wembley, to have a successful season like they have. Top six finish would have been a huge achievement for me, to get to the final and to have a one-off opportunity against Villa in a final in short distance time. It's going to be a huge, huge plus for the club. And you can see, I think, with how he's acted, how he's reacted to winning games and getting first to the playoffs and then getting to the final, the fans have responded to that. They want pride, they want passion, and he's given that in an abundance.
You mentioned it is a young side that Frank's got, and it is for the most part, apart from Richard Keogh. I think calling him young would be extremely generous these days. he's a bloke you know a little bit, I'm sure. What have you made of his resurgence and that, or that pass for that goal? That was something like an attacking midfielder would do.
It was. Richard's an extremely talented footballer. He's had his critics over his time at Derby County. There's obviously the mistake at the last Wembley final. And some fans just can't seem to let moments go. And what he's done has been an outstanding servant to Derby County. He's become an international for Ireland. He's been a captain for probably six or seven managers now at the club. Mm. Not only is he a terrific defender in terms of he'll put his body on the line, he'll make blocks, he'll make his headers, but he's a very good footballer. And you have to have, if you receive any sort of criticism as a footballer and you get a bit of stick, which he has received over the last few years, to still keep doing it, still be positive, still have the belief and the confidence to get on the ball and try and make things happen is a huge credit to him. And he's been a massive part of this club. Mm. Having young lads alongside him, he's got Bogle one side, and Tomori the other, his experience, his knowledge, his willingness to perform week in, week out has held the whole team in good stead. And that's why, you know, like I say, six or seven managers have always reverted back to Richard to be the captain of the club.
Mm. Right, playoff final, something you know a little bit about. Obviously, you were part of the Blackpool team that got promoted back in 06, 07, I think.
A long time ago, yeah.
They tend to be very, very tight in count. So many 1-0s. You look at the history of it, I think there's about 7 of the last 12 are 1-0. Just tell me a little bit about the pressure that goes into those playoff finals and how is it terrifying as a player? Do you feel it?
I had this conversation yesterday when I was at Blackpool and we got to the final. Probably quite strangely, the whole club, the whole set of fans, the whole team just knew we were going to win. There was complete confidence, complete belief. I think we'd won 8 or 9 on the bounce prior to the Wembley final against Yeovil. We'd struggled against Yeovil in the previous season. I think they beat us twice over the course of the season. And there was no doubt from any one of the players going into that final that we were going to win. Mm. We ended up winning 2-0. I think they had one opportunity in the whole game. We completely dominated the game. And that's probably strange going into a final. Last time Derby got to the final, they were clear favourites under Steve McLaren. Again, they were coming into the playoffs full of confidence and playing extremely well. But we all know it's about moments. It's normally tight, it's normally cagey. It's probably that one moment that can change things. And for me, over the two legs in the tie with Derby and Leeds, the goal just before half-time changed the whole complexion of the game yesterday. And if you're, I suppose, consistent in terms of your defending and you make the right decisions, normally the team that, you know, are more probably controlled in the environment, in the atmosphere, come out on top. But it's going to be a tough game. There's two very good footballing sides. There's real talented players in there. For me, if they keep Grealish quiet, who's obviously come to the fray again after his injury, they've got every chance. But it'll be definitely an interesting time.
Just finally, Sean, we talk about those moments in playoff finals, and somehow it always seems to be, I think, of Dean Windass, Kevin Phillips, you know, these experienced guys who pop up with a goal at the right place at the right time. Apart from Richard, as we've mentioned, there's a lot of youth in this team, but that doesn't mean they won't step up. Is there one player who you look at and think he's the kind of guy who, at the right moment, when he needs to be, will do what he has to do to get the win?
I think if you look at the course of the season, Mason Mount's been the biggest influence in terms of what he offers the team and how he can influence the whole side and how they play. We've seen Wilson over the course of the season, you know, the likes of his free kick against Manchester United and numerous other occasions where his left foot is kind of gets us out of trouble to a degree. So them two are standouts. But I think by the time the final arrives, Waghorn, Nugent should be fit. So maybe that little bit of experience will come into play more than it did last night. Yeah. Obviously, you relied on Richard Keogh and Malone and players like that and Huddleston. I think they'll have a bigger squad to choose from.
Yeah.
You know, you never know. Just having that raw talent and belief has got them as far as it has done. So, for me, Mason Mount will be the one to keep quiet for Aston Villa if they want to go any further.
Hmm. Sean, thank you so much for coming on. Great to hear from you as well. A real club legend there. Sean Barker, former Derby County captain there, talking about Mason Mount to be the playoff final hero for Derby County. They're going to need one. They might need more than one. And it'll be Lampard versus Terry on the touchline.
This is Love Sport.
Now, Wilfried Zaha, a man who is a bit of a legend in London when it comes to football, certainly in South London, but he has reportedly told the club that he wants to leave this summer. They are reluctant to sell the winger, but he's reiterated his desire to play Champions League football. Zaha scored 10 times in an impressive 2018-19 Premier League campaign. He's keen to test himself at the highest level of club football and start regularly challenging to trophies. Remember that he is already 26 and he has already been to Manchester United, an ill-fated spell after he went there for £15 million and was sold back 2 years later. But he thinks he's ready for the change. And in an interview with the Mail last month, he said, "I have to experience the Champions League. I just need the opportunity. That's it, and I'll do the rest. I'm too ambitious. I'm not ambitious just to play for a top club, but to win things at club level and with the Ivory Coast. I'm blessed to have come this far in my playing career, but I feel there's so much more I have to offer." I think that might feel like a little bit of a kick in the teeth for Palace fans. If you are a Palace fan and you want to talk about Wilfried Zaha, give us a ring on 0208 70 20 558. You can also get in touch on socials at Love Sport Radio on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. Drop us a tweet and we'll read that out on air and talk about your opinions, because we are here to give you a voice. Wilfried Zaha's voice appears to be wanting away from Crystal Palace. For me, the problem is I don't know where he's going to go. Now, it's does he want to play Champions League football or does he want to earn Champions League money? Obviously, both is what you want to do. But when I look at it and I work out all the places he could go to play Champions League football, it doesn't really add up. Let's just run through them, shall we? Man City. I don't think they're ever going to sign Wilfried Zaha. Frankly, it doesn't feel like a good fit. I don't think he's of the level of player that they're going to sign. And frankly, after his time at United, I wouldn't blame Wilfried Zaha for never wanting to go into the city of Manchester ever again. Liverpool, I actually think, has a little bit of legs, because he feels like the kind of player who will benefit from the arm around the shoulder that Jurgen Klopp offers. You know, that kind of 10 feet tall motivational tactic and also really asking a lot from your players. I feel like Zaha, with that ambition, I think he would really benefit from working under Jurgen Klopp. He'd enjoy the high energy, high intensity football that Liverpool play. The problem is that he'll have to sit on the bench quite a lot. He might only play 25 games a season at a push, and maybe 10 of those will be starts, you know, unless someone gets seriously injured. If that's what he wants, fine, it might be for him. But if the asking price is £80 million, will Liverpool pay that for a bench rider? Don't rule that out, by the way. Remember that Manchester City paid £75 million for Riyad Mahrez, didn't they? Something like that? It was an absurd fee. And he's a bloke who barely starts, but when they did need him, he delivered. Last day of the season, came in and delivered. And that's what you need to challenge on four fronts. So don't rule out Liverpool paying £80 million for a bloke who's not going to start very regularly. Whether Wilfried Zaha is that bloke, I don't know. Chelsea looks like a good fit, but they're likely to have a transfer ban this summer, unless they can swing a delay, which is obviously what the Spanish clubs have often been afforded. They're going to court arbitration for Sport, but that feels a bit like a boggle box when it comes to getting a verdict at the moment. It has been done before, though. That does still probably render his moving there unlikely. He's definitely a spanner in the works. Even if he was to go there, would he walk into the Chelsea first team? Remember that Christian Pulisic is coming over this summer. Callum Hudson-Odoi, when fit, probably has more potential and more ability than Wilfried Zaha. So I don't think he starts. A little bit like Liverpool, he would have to rotate in and out. He'd be a backup player. Does he want to do that? If he's ambitious, does he want to go and sit on the bench in the Champions League? I don't know. Tottenham's a decent move for him. Obviously, still in the same city. I think that's big. You have to remember this is a guy who's been at Palace, 15 years with a little two-year frisson at Manchester United. So he's obviously very, very well rooted in London. They're likely to play him a bit more because they have a smaller squad. And he might get into their starting lineup. When they're playing 4-2-3-1, I think he fits in quite well. And he'd also probably see himself as a bit of a backup to Harry Kane. Could play on his own up front at times. The problem? Daniel Levy's unlikely to sanction 80-odd million quid for him. That asking price, I think, is optimistic, since we've mentioned it a couple of times. I think Palace would take 55, 60 million pounds for him. Surely they would. But nevertheless, it's a hefty wedge of money. And as for the other potential, and they're not even a Champions League club at the moment, Arsenal, the reality is they can't afford him. They can't spend that kind of money on a player because, they simply don't have it. And to be honest, their fans are going to be skint after next week as well because, as has been mentioned in a club statement from Arsenal, everyone at the club is delighted to have reached the Europa League final. We're looking forward to the match against Chelsea, but we're bitterly disappointed by the fact that due to transport limitations, UEFA can only make a maximum of 6,000 tickets available to Arsenal for a stadium with a capacity of well over 60,000. Time will tell if it's even possible for 6,000 Arsenal fans to attend the match, given how extreme the travel challenges are. They are extreme travel challenges. People paying four figures. People who I can see in front of me paying four figures to go to Baku in Azerbaijan. Not necessarily Arsenal fans. You know, it's a massive challenge. And you have to question, when UEFA looked at it, and I know there are financial benefits from taking a final to Azerbaijan. I understand that. But when they looked at it, and when they did their feasibility study, and when Azerbaijan presented the package saying, this is what we can offer as a stadium, did it really say, yep, we've got the infrastructure. Yep, our airport can handle it. Yes, we've got the hotel provision. I struggle to believe that it did.
This is Love Sport.
And now we're going to talk a little bit about pressure because it's playoff season, it's cup final season, and the pressure is starting to get to players and even some fans. Let's talk to George Caceres, sports psychologist, friend of the show, about pressure. George, it's almost a commentator's cliche to say pressure does funny things to people. From your perspective, what does pressure do to us?
Well, it depends, James, on who we are and how our brains work. Sometimes the pressure can be seen to be helpful and exciting and enjoyable, and we can have a great time with it. Other times it can crucify us and send our knees to wobbly states and cause us to have horrible experiences. So broadly speaking, though, what happens under pressure is that parts of our brain, when we get stressed, we release a hormone called the adrenocorticotropic hormone, and that then releases something called cortisol, and that changes our physiology. It changes the blood rushes to parts of our bodies that we need to act on. The eyes narrow, the heart beats a bit faster, we sweat, and we focus a bit more on the threat that's in front of us. And sometimes that can cause us to freeze or run away or stand and fight. So there's a physiological change that goes on, and that then affects what we see on the TV.
So I understand that. I think this is what people call a flight or fight reflex. Is that right? And I understand those two things from a sort of evolutionary caveman aspect. Is you get in a situation, you're facing a wild animal or something, and yeah, you either run away or fight it. But I'm interested in the freezing, in the And I've felt it. For example, I sang a gig last night, and I'm famously terrible under pressure.
Yeah.
And you feel it. You feel that instinct to just your mind almost goes completely blank, and you forget words. You forget how to tie your shoelaces. Mm. I find that absolutely fascinating. As a psychologist yourself, how would you try and work with someone who has that third reaction, that freezing reaction? How do you deal with it?
Well, it's a good it's a great question, and I think everyone who sort of fears standing up and making a speech or taking a penalty or something where you're in the public eye to some degree goes through the same experiences. I mean, this response that you had last night, James. I mean, that's really down to a perception that you have of your ability to cope with the situation, not quite matching the perceived threat of the situation. So what we try to do is we try to reduce the perception that people have of something being a threat, and we try to help them to reframe it into something which is more helpful, like an opportunity or something that other people will benefit from. So we try to maybe if I was working with you last night, I might say to you, well, think about what you're doing for other people and stop thinking about yourself so much, and how people are going to enjoy you singing, and be a bit more thoughtful to others. That would probably help take the pressure off a little bit. But the other part of it is your perceived ability to cope. So I don't know what your voice is like, but if you've got a good set of confidence that you can sing, and you've prepared and you've practiced and you know your stuff and you've got some kind of mental picture of what you're going to go through, then the chances are you wouldn't have been in such shock, I would have thought.
So to bring it back to football, apart from my singing career, fledgling and amateur as it is, essentially what you're saying is, as a player, you need to sit there and go through, almost relive all the practice sessions, all the training, all the preparation, because you are, in many ways, for these games, you're more prepared than you ever have been. You know, you should be, at least, in the perfect state. I just wonder whether... Sorry, I'm sorry to cut you off. I wanted to ask you, especially because with relevance to last night, Derby are this very young team.
Yeah.
And I wonder... You know, people always talk about having these old experienced heads and the importance of that.
Yeah.
If you had to choose a young team or an old team in a pressure situation, what are the relative merits of those two sort of makeups of characters?
Yeah, well, that's a real conundrum, isn't it? I mean, Germany did very well, didn't they, in the World Cup with a very young team, and England had a more experienced team and froze. I mean, they were anxious. Boris Becker won Wimbledon at 17 and didn't have a care in the world, but Federer and Nadal are still overcoming the more inexperienced, nervous competitors on the tour. So look, anxiety, neuroticism tends to get a little bit less as we get older. I mean, there's a slight gender difference as well. So women are typically more neurotic in the early stages than men, and then there's a narrowing of that. They tend to get much less anxious as they get older, until the age of 70, when we get a bit more anxious as we get older.
Right.
So the answer to the question, obviously, is not wait till people are 70. That's not going to work so well. But the answer is obviously to pick the right people with the right mentality. And experience is probably where coaches go to. And if you've got someone who's experienced, they know how to handle it, then you've got a safer bet, I would think, than somebody who's young. Well, you're not quite sure whether they can deal with the situation and have worked out strategies to cope with it. So that's why I think coaches tend to go with experienced heads.
George, thank you so much for coming on. Always a pleasure to have you and talk about this topic. George Caceres there, sports psychologist. Pressure is a funny thing. You can feel it in your bones, in your hands, in your palms, in your arms, in your knees. But that's what makes sport so exciting at this end of the season. The pressure, it makes strange things happen, and boy, it's exciting to watch.
This is Love Sport.
We've been handed the England squad for the UEFA Nations League finals. Southgate's named a preliminary 27-man squad, which he will cut down to 23 ahead of the semi-final with the Netherlands in Guimaraes on Thursday, June the 6th. I'll just run you through the squad quickly. Alexander-Arnold, Butland, Barkley, Chilwell, Dele Alli, Delph, Dyer, Gomez, Heaton, Henderson, Kane, Keane, Lingard, Maguire, Pickford, Rashford, Redmond, Rice, Rose, Sancho, Sterling, Stone, Trippier, Walker, Ward-Prowse, Wilson, Winks. Callum Wilson, well rewarded for his fine form at Bournemouth with a place in the squad. If he can hang on to it, that would be very good indeed. He says he's named Harry Kane, even though he's currently injured, just basically just in case. Southgate says, in case he does recover in time. Of course, that game will be just a few days after the Champions League final, with Liverpool, Tottenham and Chelsea all involved in the UEFA finals. Players from those clubs are expected to join the group in the week commencing Monday, June the 3rd, before they travel to Portugal. Not a lot of turnaround time there. You know, if you're Liverpool or Tottenham, frankly, and you win the Champions League final, I don't think you're going to be having a quiet night in the library. I don't think that's very likely. So play on the Saturday. Probably go out Saturday night if you win. That's going to be half the squad because Tottenham and Liverpool have so many England players. Recover Sunday. Maybe fly back to Blighty Sunday afternoon. Fly over to Portugal on Monday. I don't think you're going to be in great shape for a game on Thursday, but we'll see. Nathan Redmond, a little bit of a surprise inclusion. Southampton forward had a strong finish to his season at Southampton. Luke Shaw is probably the big missing name. He's, frankly, I think he's been all right. People say he's been playing pretty well at Man United, the left back, but no place for him. Ben Chilwell, of course, is starting to nail down that slot as his own. Danny Rose is included as well, but as I say, no place for Luke Shaw, so he has dropped down the pecking order at left back. Very disappointing for the Manchester United fullback in what's been a pretty up and down year. I'm sure Southgate will have spoken to him and explained exactly why, which is more than can be said for Jose Mourinho, who probably would have just done a sort of quite annoying interview and then just, you know, called him fat or said he had an attitude problem. No Luke Shaw, but Nathan Redmond has been included in England's squad. No Ruben Loftus-Cheek, of course, either. I suspect he would have been involved. He's been playing really well for Chelsea the last couple of weeks, but he has injured his Achilles, we fear, last night in a friendly against the Revolution over in the States, where Chelsea played a full team, which I can scarcely believe. Absolutely baffling to me. I understand the game. Raised $4 million for charity. Great. And they went and did some really good awareness stuff the day before, which, given the year Chelsea have had off the field, I think is important. It's good that they're pushing that. I know Roman Abramovich was heavily involved in this trip. Now, we'll move on to it a bit more later, but I don't disagree it's a good thing to do. Great to run these charity events, but you've got to think about the timing. You know when the Europa League final is. Don't book a charity game the week before. Madness. Let's move on to our Love Sport Awards, which are potentially a little premature as well, but who cares? We have, of course, Team of the Year involving Wolves, Manchester City, Tottenham and Liverpool. You can have your say on Twitter. If you head over to Love Sport Radio, you'll find the polls for the awards, which will close on Monday lunchtime. In terms of Team of the Year, we've been interviewing as many people as we can to talk about these awards and who deserves it and who doesn't. We had Wolves legend Jody Craddock on Love Sport earlier this week, and he said, well, obviously he was backing his old team.
Yeah, I'm not going to lie, I think I am surprised. I think I'd have said half, you know, half the table at the start of the season, you know, but as a newly promoted team, it's always, right, let's go for, you know, go for survival. Let's, you know, put our base down, make sure we don't get relegated. I think they've surpassed everybody's kind of expectations. Maybe not the manager's expectations. You know, maybe he knew that's how good they were. We knew they were good from last season. But you never know going into the Premiership. You just don't know because it's that tough a division. Mm. And they've been fantastic. And, you know, waiting on Man City in the FA Cup, they could be in Europa next season, which, wow, what a fantastic feat that would be for the Wolves and the fans and everybody involved around the city.
Jody Craddock there talking about our nomination of Wolves for Team of the Year in the Premier League. Man City, Liverpool and Tottenham, the three others. Liverpool, of course, for running Man City pretty close with 97 points and reaching a Champions League final. Tottenham, similarly, finishing in the top four, moving into their new stadium. Not made a single signing since January 2018, but they've made it through to the Champions League final. And Man City, of course, on track for a domestic treble. We've also got a couple of other sections. The Best Newcomer Award. We were speaking to Jody about that as well, actually, because Raul Jimenez is on the list. Jimenez, Lucas Torreira, David Brooks and Aaron Wan-Bissaka all involved in that shortlist. I believe Aaron Wan-Bissaka has an early lead over the other three, but you can change that. You head over to at Love Sport Radio and you will find on Twitter the polls for our awards. Our Best of the Rest as well. Which players have the best season outside the top six Premier League teams? We've gone with Ruben Neves, James Maddison, Declan Rice and Ryan Fraser. Have your pick of those four. And then finally, the much vaunted Flop of the Season award. This can be a player or a team, frankly. So we've gone Fulham, the entire club, Gonzalo Higuain, Alexis Sanchez and Kieran Trippier. Massive summer and a really underwhelming season at Tottenham. I feel a bit bad for him, really, because expectations were so high. But he very much has flopped on the back of that World Cup summer. Have your say on Twitter at Love Talk Radio. Or if you think we've missed someone out, give us a ring on 0208 70 2558. Maybe you think we should have included someone else. Is Ben Foster maybe one of the most valuable players outside the top six? Certainly Watford fans have been saying to me that he's had one of the seasons of his career.
Love Sport.
Let's speak to a Watford legend in the shape of Micah Hyde, who has got more than 250 appearances for the club between 1997 and 2004. He's on the line now. Micah, I assume you have to believe, that Watford have a chance on Saturday.
Of course. Especially after the last couple of weeks we've had in Europe, I believe even more. It's true, anything's possible in 9 minutes. So yeah, definitely a believer.
How big is it for the club just to get to the FA Cup final? When you consider they've never won the FA Cup, they've not been in the final since I think 1984. How important is it just to have this opportunity?
Fantastic, just to be there where they are is a great opportunity for the club, the community, the environment in Watford. It shows progression. I think their performances over the course of the season has been very good, and that's got to be the barometer going into the next season. And hopefully, we can keep ourselves up in the top six next season and push on from where we are. Yeah, but yeah, fantastic achievement so far, but it's not one that we should rest on. I think we should keep going, because I think the squad's good. There's not a good squad going there.
What is the sort of medium to long-term goal for Watford? Do you think it's realistic to say they can break into that top six in the Premier League?
It's a push. It's an ask, because it's, historically, as we know, there's been a certain amount of teams and that are always in the top six fighting for them European places. But for Watford, I think they've got to be looking to push into it. Sure, certainly, I think there's an opportunity for them to get into it. You're talking, they'll be competing with the likes you would imagine with Everton and so on and so forth. So I think, yeah, there's a chance for them to definitely be looking to crack into Europe next season. Now, that means a top six finish. I don't think that's an unrealistic achievement, considering what they've done this season.
Saturday, of course, we've got Aurelio Gomez likely to start in goal instead of Ben Foster. He's played all the way through in the FA Cup final, but obviously Ben's had a great season in goal for Watford. Would you be tempted for the final just to say, look, mate, we've got to put our best bloke in goal, we've got to put Ben in?
Personally, yeah, I would personally. If I was the manager of the team, I'd be looking to win the game, so I'd be looking to put the players that I believe... Not that Gomez is not going to win us the game. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that if I was the person in charge of the question you've asked me, I'd probably be likely to go with possibly the strongest team I could go with. But it's an opportunity, a one-off game. You know, if we win, we all win, if that makes sense. So Gomez wins if we win, doesn't he? So, yeah, I'll go with the strongest team.
And good news for Watford over the week. Jose Halevas having his red card rescinded. How important is he to Watford's hopes this weekend? You think, obviously, he's a big set-piece taker.
Yeah. He's a big threat. You know, I think he's been very good this season. The season before last, I wasn't sure. But he's had competition this season, and we've seen that in his performance, so that's good. I think he'd be a massive loss if he wasn't available, so I'm really glad he is.
Yeah.
He's a threat coming forward, and he's defending very well this season, to be fair.
How important do you think Javi Gracia has been? Because we've got quite used to Watford coaches coming like buses, you know, three of them at once, and that they kind of come and go. We just became used to that. And Javi Gracia has brought a bit of stability, it seems. How big do you think that's been for the club overall success?
Massive. Because, well, the years I was there, we had stability. There was a little bit of time of uncertainty. But a club of what the stature, I think stability is key. I'm glad he's coming and he's stabilised it. I thought the team was a bit industrious before last season. But now they've added some flair, and I think it's looking really good. I just hope the owners see what he's doing and they're... back him regardless, but obviously give him the chance to keep going and keep going.
Michael, I just want to change tack for a moment, because I know that now that you've retired, you've done lots of work in coaching and things, and we were at an event earlier this week with Show the Races and the Red Card, talking about getting more black and BAME coaches into football. And I wonder how you felt as a black man working as a football coach. do you feel that you got enough opportunities, and do you think that people like you get enough opportunities to work in football?
No, I'm not sure of that, no. I've applied twice for a job at Watford, and I'm going to add an interview. I'm not saying I'll be worthy of doing a job at Watford, but it'd be nice to get an interview considering I've got all my qualifications and experience. So, yeah, to answer your question, I say no. I think what's really great is that we've got four English teams in Europe, but four of them English teams are managed by foreign managers. So, for me, it's going to push black managers like myself, or black aspiring people like myself, even further down the pecking order. The chairman now is going to look and say, well, we're not going to point him. Let's go and point, you know, a reserve under 23 from a different country, because we've seen what these foreign managers bring in, these different ideas. But they're failing to see that diversity is diversity in itself. So a foreign manager is going to be as diverse as a black manager, a black manager is going to be as diverse as a white manager. So they don't see this. So for me, the answer to your question is no. And I'm really passionate about football. Everyone knows this. I love football. I'm really passionate about football. I know they understand the game, but I'm not wholeheartedly to think that if I carry on and be really, really passionate, do all my badges and keep striving, that I want to get the same opportunity as I did as a player. Unfortunately, look, at the moment, that's not the case.
Do you think
I'm
it needs...
I'm not bitter about it. I'm not.
No.
I understand. And, no, I don't accept it, but I understand it, you know, for sure.
Do you think it needs something like the Rooney Rule so that, you know, it is compulsory to interview a black candidate for every job that comes up?
I'm not sure, to be honest with you, because ultimately the chairman has a decision to make, and he will make the ultimate decision, to be honest with you. I think the Rooney Rule has been successful in the USA, so I wouldn't discount it here, for sure. Anything that's positive towards trying to make a change is positive in itself. But for me, I just think there's no opportunity at the moment for any black or BME aspiring coach or veteran coach or A coach to get to the level of some of our peers. It's extremely hard, and I think it is what it is. Like I said, anything positive will be good.
Mike, go on, carry on.
On the positive note, we have to keep striving forward and keep empowering ourselves and keep positive. Don't be, you know, looking for people to help. Like I've done, I look to keep being positive and empowering myself to keep going forward.
Micah, thank you so much for your time. Real pleasure to talk to you and to hear someone with your passion about the game as well. I'm sure we'll talk to you again. Maybe, hopefully, when Watford are FA Cup champions after the weekend. Best of luck. Take it easy. That's Micah Hyde there, former Watford player and also now a coach. I mean, always interesting to talk to anyone who's working in football on the coaching side, especially people from black or Asian minority ethnic backgrounds, because there are so few people like that on the coaching side of the game. And there are so many people like that. You know, I think it's over a third of starting lineups in the Premier League now are people from black or Asian minority ethnic backgrounds. Essentially, black people dominate football on the pitch. Why don't they dominate football off the pitch? It's a question that we have to keep asking. And you can hear it in Micah's voice there. He's passionate about the game and he feels like he's not getting opportunities and he feels like race has something to do with that.
This is Love Sport.
Now, speaking of the Europa League final, one man who won't be featuring, we understand, and who won't be in the Nations League either is Ruben Loftus-Cheek. Now, that will surprise you if you're a Chelsea fan and maybe you've just woken up or you're just picking up the news that he injured his Achilles overnight in America. Now, what's he doing in America? Do you remember when Mo Salah went to the States for an awards ceremony just before the end of the season? And Liverpool fans are up in arms going, what's he doing? Why is he going all the way over to the States, picking up an award, coming back, jet lag, keeping himself cooped up in a plane for 3 or 4 hours? It's dangerous, it must be bad for him. This is why he's going to underperform. Imagine that, but it's your whole squad going over to the States. And then imagine it's your whole squad going over to the States and playing a game. And then imagine it's your whole squad going to the States, playing a game on a dodgy pitch. And one of them gets injured. How inevitable is that? This game kind of came out of nowhere for me because I don't follow Chelsea's friendly fixtures. But when I saw it was happening, I thought, right, well, surely they're not going to play a full team. Because that would just be just foolish. You know, they'll maybe send over a couple of stars, maybe Hazard will come and do a few keepy uppies at halftime, but they can't possibly pick a full team, play loads of the kids and, you know, just, you know, tick the box 2 weeks before a Europa League final, because you can't afford to take the risk, surely. It's too important to go out and win silverware. Nope, Chelsea picked a full team. They picked a full team to play the New England Revolution in a post-season friendly. The headline on the Chelsea website, or the top paragraph, Three goals, two scored by Ross Barkley, one by Olivier Giroud, plus $4 million raised for a range of organisations are the headline figures from Chelsea's game last night against the New York Revolution. It's a good news story, isn't it? That's the spin the club are trying to put on it. But all any Chelsea fan will have seen waking up this morning is Ruben Loftus-Cheek on crutches 2 weeks before a major European Cup final against Arsenal. How does that make any sense to play that game then? I get that the charity game is important, and it's great, really good, and it's the right thing to do. And Chelsea went over, actually, and with all the racism and anti-Semitism stuff that's been flying around football this year, it's great that Chelsea went out of their way to have a look at some projects about that and visit a couple of museums and things. Great messaging from the club. So credit to them for that. But horrendous timing. Just horrendous timing. To pick Arrizabalaga, Zappa Costa, Christensen, Luis Alonso, Barkley, Jorginho, Kovacic, Pedro, Giroud, Hazard. That team could start the Europa League final. No one would be surprised if it did. So why on earth are they playing a charity game before the season has ended? You could have gone and done this on your pre-season tour. Quite easily done this on your pre-season tour. Taken the players there, done all the bits and pieces, played the game against New York Revolution, raised all the money that you're planning on raising. But why do you have to do it before the end of the season? Pre-season would have been the perfect time. Now, I know that Chelsea are going to Japan in July to play Barcelona, and I know why they're going to Japan in July to play Barcelona. It's partly because they're sponsored by Yokohama Tyres, and also because that game, commercially, is extremely lucrative. This charity game, commercially, probably isn't that lucrative because it all goes to charity. So they think, well, why would we put this in prime commercial real estate when we can put it during the season when we would never be allowed to play just a money-spinning friendly? So we'll put it just after the end of the Premier League season, even though they know that there's an FA Cup final and a Europa League final before the end of May. These fixtures have been set for months, years even, and they knew when it was going to be. They knew the competitions they were involved with, and they still decided to put it on this date. And then, I don't imagine Maurizio Sarri will have said, I want to pick my first team tonight, it's important game. I don't imagine that. But I do imagine that the call might have come from upstairs saying, Maurizio, this charity game is really important to the boss. Because this is Roman Abramovich's brainchild, by the way. And so they go, oh, yeah, the boss really likes this, so you probably have to pick a full team. And he goes, what? He's like, it's not really your choice at this point, mate. And he picks a full team. And Ruben Loftus-Cheek must just feel like the world's against him. I don't doubt he wanted to play. I don't think players tend to play if they don't want to play. They just say, oh, my back hurts. In Ruben's case, it would have been pretty realistic. But I don't think they will play if they don't want to play. But you have to protect players from themselves. You have to say to them, actually, lads, we've still got this bit of the season, so we need to rest you. It's been the end of a long year. Most of you played in the World Cup over the summer as well. It's not sensible for you to go out on a pitch that I would have been disappointed to play on a Sunday and, you know, have a crack at New England Revolution. Not worth it. Not worth their time. And now Ruben Loftus-Cheek's potentially going to miss a major European Cup final when, frankly, he's in the form of his life. I can't remember Ruben Loftus-Cheek playing this well for Chelsea as he has been recently. And he probably would have started that game against Arsenal, right, in Baku. It's not what we all dreamed of, but it is a European final. And if Ruben Loftus-Cheek gets to the end of his career and he's never won a European trophy, and let's face it, that happens to a lot of people, it's a rare honour. If he gets to the end and he's not won a European trophy and Chelsea get beaten by Arsenal, he thinks, I could have influenced that game. And he's sitting in an armchair, age 40, and he goes, I never won a European final. Who's he going to blame? He's going to blame Roman Abramovich for booking this game on the date he's booked it because he didn't want to put it in prime commercial real estate in July. It's absolute madness, and it's not preserving the players' welfare, quite frankly. Eden Hazard, for example, I've no doubt he wanted to play. They always want to play, but you have to protect them from themselves. And it's so disappointing that Chelsea have managed to do this. They've managed to take what is essentially a really good PR day. You know, let's face it, they've had some bad PR this year. there's the Raheem Sterling incident. There's the ongoing talk about the Y word, about anti-Semitic chanting. It's not been great. Oh, and they've been booing their manager from pillar to post, even though they finished third and are in a European Cup final. So it's not been a great year. And this is a great chance to have a good bit of PR. But why not do it as a pre-season friendly? Why not say, actually, we're not going to go to Japan and play Barcelona in a game that would admittedly make the club loads. But we think these matters, we care so much about these things. We give so much to charity. We're going to give $4 million to charity and we give up a bit of a time to play a commercial friendly. This is how much we care about this sort of thing. That we're going to go and play a pre-season friendly there in our prime real estate for commercial revenue. It would send such a message about what Chelsea Football Club think. Not to mention all the positive PR, but it would turbocharge all of that. As it is, their good PR story, the story that says 3 goals scored, 2 by Ross Barkley, 1 by Olivier Giroud, and $4 million raised for a range of organisations, that story is buried under Ruben Loftus-Cheek, ruptures Achilles tendon, and is out of the Nations League, is out of the Europa League final, has his career set back again. Does he need that? No. Does Chelsea need that? No. But does Roman Abramovich need the cash and the good PR? Yes.
This is Love Sport.
You've been listening to Upfront with James Gray, the podcast edition. You can listen to me live every weekday from 1 till 3pm on Love Sport Radio. And don't forget to leave us a rating and a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.